It's wonderful to see you here so bright and early. Thank you very much to everyone here in the Burgage Hall. Thank you to everyone who's joining us online, wherever you're joining from. I'm particularly thrilled by the people from New York who have been up very early to see this event. My name is Peter Florence. I'm a patron of Ledbury Poetry, and I am joined by the most incredibly wonderful panel. Ulrike Almuth-Sandig is the most glorious German poet. She is translated by Karen Leder, who is also professor of German literature at Oxford. And Martin Crucifix, a poet in his own right of great acclaim, is also the translator of both Sonnets to Orpheus and the Duino Elegies. We should say this is the final, the climactic moment of this Dead Poets series season. We have listened to Shakespeare finding ways to cope with his own humanity. We have followed Chaucer's pilgrims on a religious quest that ends with the most startlingly and graphically human responses. We have wondered with T.S. Eliot's Wasteland about what modernity might mean. And we started way back with the Psalms, a jubilation, a sure and certain hope that God was with us and going to intervene on our behalf. So obviously we end with Rilke. Can I start this by just visiting the moment in 1912 of inspiration for this extraordinary 10-poem sequence, which is eventually completed in a burst of extraordinary creativity in February 1922. Karen, can you just set up the first line of this project and what it means?
Yes, it's one of the most famous first lines that there is in the 20th century. So Rilke had begun the writing the elegies back in Duino 10 years before, and had had a kind of creative, began writing the elegies back in the early days, and after a kind of creative block, and then he was to go into a creative block. But while he was there in Duino on the Adriatic coast as the guest of the Princess Marie von Thurn und Taxis, one of a number of rich women who were his patrons during his life, and he was there to kind of recuperate and was walking on the sea cliffs when out of the storm, a voice seemed to call to him in perfectly rhythmical German. Wer, wenn ich schrie, hörte mich denn aus der Engelordnung? Who, if I cried out, would hear me among the ranks of the angels? A sort of astonishing voice out of the storm, or rather like Yeats, a kind of, that came into him. And at first he sort of set it aside, but then it became the impetus of this extraordinary cycle, and he wrote then very, very quickly the first elegy. But the first line, I think everyone will have something to say about it, but one of the strange things is that it calls on a kind of angelic realm beyond, but it's the opposite of what you'd normally expect, a kind of inspiration coming to the poet, but rather the poet calling, or a voice calling to the angels. But more than that, it doesn't actually happen. It's all put into the subjunctive. Who, if I cried out, would hear me among the ranks of the angels? And not very long after, we hear, so I hold back, so I don't call. So it's this extraordinary call up into the unknown, up into a transcendent realm, that is the kind of lightning bolt that ignites the elegies.
Yes, I think it's really important that the cry doesn't happen. I think that opening line is a sign really of the desperate situation that the individual finds himself in, solitary, alienated, seeking help, but not sure where to turn for that. he chooses the ranks of the angels, because I think that's probably the just the accepted place where one should be turning. But I think ultimately the elegies, for me anyway, turn away from the angels in many ways, and he finds help. Not, ouch. That's the angels. We had the bells ringing yesterday in the Passeggiata when Ulrika was ringing, just at the right time. So God is clearly there. I don't really think Rilke does have a faith in anything resembling that traditional God, and I don't think the angels are really there for him. I always read this opening as a kind of an invocation as well, as a poet beginning an epic poem or something like that. You would traditionally call out for help from above, and this seems almost to be a kind of ironic example of that as well. He doesn't call out, and there is no answer. The next few lines go on to suggest that even if there was an answer, the angels would be so terrifying that you would just kind of frazzle up in their approach.
Ulrika, it's such an iconic line. What does it do for German literature? That's a ridiculous question, because not only is it an iconic line to begin this appeal, as Martin suggests, it's also sort of calls in the whole of the 20th century, doesn't it? Or has now become to call it in.
No, yeah, it has been. There has been loads of intimidations coming from Rilke to poets of my generation and of the generations that came before me. So I think Rilke and it's not the only canonized line by Rilke, like "Du musst dein Leben ändern," you have to change your line, as probably a line that a person would know even though they don't know that it's actually from Rilke, which is a feature of canonized poets at all. But actually, I'm not sure, just coming back to the cry, I'm not sure the cry is really not happening. I think I used to read it like that, but yesterday I read it again and I thought there is two sorts of cries happening. One, but both of them are not directed to the angels, of course, because also throughout the whole elegy, what's the English word, elegies, there is not a single line that can address directly to the angels, as you said, because they are too terrifying. But when we read again the German, "Wer, wenn ich schrie, hörte mich denn aus der Engel Ordnungen?" The "wer" in its the way it stands in the beginning with a comma right after it, it's not possible to read this line without having like a cry in yourself. Wer, so the wer itself is sort of a very small, like a tiny cry that introduces to me the whole number of elegies, actually, because they themselves are the cries that Rilke directs not to the angels but to the readers instead. So to me, the specific tone that Rilke puts on in these elegies has a lot to do with bursting out language, but not bursting like in a chaotic, expressive form, but in a very, like a cry in a musical form, I'd say. Yeah, like a very precise, well, like a tuned forte fortissimo cry, something like that.
Brilliant. Thank you. Can I just, before we move forward with the elegies, go backwards to the context in which these poems are written. And I want to go to his own life, but before that, can we just discuss what is happening in Germany, specifically in relation to God? You know, Darwin has a phenomenal impact, doesn't he, on German culture? Karen.
Yes. So the beginning of the 20th century in Germany, for a writer like Rilke, who grew up in a, was never religious, but grew up in a conventional religious household, encountered Darwin, Nietzsche, and the splitting of the atom. And all three of them, in a sense, fundamentally removed the human being from the center of the universe. So the atom was split, that was supposed to be the smallest thing. You know, there could be nothing small, and yet it was split. Freud, in the background, I should have said Freud. Four things. Freud. What did the Romans do for us? Fourth. Freud. Freud, you know, again, removed the sense of the self from the center of the self, and suddenly people were struggling with unknown desires and the id, which comes up, of course, in the third elegy. And then Nietzsche, God is dead. This is a world, this is a godless world, and I think, and then Darwin again then replacing this, the human mode at the centre of the world, and forcing us to think about evolution and hereditary. That was a very strong interest at that time. So this kind of displacement and emptiness, and it's not for nothing that these were finished in the same year that The Wasteland was written. There is a similar kind of sense of everything falling apart, everything being atomized. And Rilke writes these elegies, I think, against this background as a way of, as a cry, I mean, Martin said they're not answered, as a way of asking who we are in the universe, where we are in the universe.
Can you both go back also to the poetic context? Germany, unusually in Europe, doesn't have this huge explosion of long-form narrative fiction in the 19th century. It does have, it's at a great golden moment for poetry. So how does he fit into that tradition?
I find it interesting. I've been working more recently on some of the earlier Rilke poetry. So back to the Book of Hours, which is 1899, 1901, 1902, and so on. There he addresses God very directly, but he addresses God with not the kind of respect that you might expect. He talks to her in one poem, he talks about God as if he was a neighbor, banging on the wall, or not banging on the wall, and he expresses a concern that something may be wrong with God, because he can't hear him next door. And he says, you know, do call me. I am very near. But again, God is not really responding, I think. So those are interesting. A number of those poems are also written in the as a persona. Rilke doesn't use persona very much, but he does on some of these, and the persona he chooses, he just visited Russia, I think, a couple of times with Lou, and he chooses the persona of a Russian icon painter. So he's presenting himself as an artist, but a more visual artist. But he seems to value the human artistic creation almost over and above God's original creation. So already in those early poems, perhaps under the influence of the woman he met, he's questioning God's role quite radically, I think.
Can we just, while since you've brought her up, can we just address Lou Andrea Salome, who is simultaneously the coolest and hottest woman in 20th century Germany? Specifically in relation to this conversation, she is intimately and intricately bound up with both Nietzsche and Freud. So do we assume that he is engaging partly, she is teaching him, she is leading him into intellectual ideas that he had not previously himself on his own discovered?
I think so. I think the question of influence is always that you know, you come across something that somehow responds to something which is perhaps already within you. So I think some of these ideas were probably within him. He met her 1897, I think it was. She was 37. He would have been 20-something. Yeah, 21. Fell under her influence. They had an affair. She'd already... she was well known in German modernist circles as a critic, as she was, wrote about philosophy. She wrote a book about her relationship with Nietzsche. So she was a really significant figure. He said, I wonder if I could read a little poem that he wrote. He said that in meeting her, he'd been writing not terribly good poetry for a decade or so before this. And he said in meeting her, the world lost its cloudiness for me. He'd been writing these rather woolly romantic poems and so on. The fluid forming and surrendering of itself, which was the manner and poverty of my first verses. So she somehow focused him. I learned a simplicity. And I think that idea of simplicity then echoes absolutely throughout the rest of his career, right to the final French poem. He wrote 400 poems in French in the last few years. There he's returned to the simplicity of the landscape and so on. But he never published it, but he wrote a little poem which actually names her and gives a rather lovely picture, I think, of the pair of them. This is my translation. The rain running its cold fingers down our windows, unseeing. We lean back in deep armchairs to listen, as if the quiet hours dripped from a weary mill all evening. Then Lou speaks, and he actually names her. Our souls incline one to another. Even cut flowers in the window nod their utmost bloom, and we are utterly at home here in this tranquil white house.
Can I ask you, Ulrika, just to talk about the language for a second? Heine, Hölderlin have set up expectations and a sort of a glorious golden age of German poetry. What does Rilke's language do? What's he changing? What's he inheriting, but also where's he taking it? And in that, is it significant that he is from Prague? Is his German unusual, coming from an Austro-Hungarian culture? What does it shift?
I don't know really, because his language has changed so much from word to word. I do see what you were. I do see the simplicity that sat in from some point, and I think he this sort of simplicity, I'm not sure whether this is the right word, but I'm sure that this, his way to put things that are complicated, very straight, has polarized his reading in the next generations, I guess. So there are lots of, I think this is the reason why he is so popular within for readers who are not necessarily into poetry. For instance, there is a range of albums. I think it's now up to 6 albums of a composers and producers couple. It's called the Rilke Project, and what they do is they compose easygoing electronic music and have prominent voices like actors and some singers performing his poetry, and they perform mostly his early works, I think. And just because they are so easy to perform, so easy to speak, so they seem simple, but they are not simple, of course. And I think there is also a crucial point, because sometimes to me it feels like this simplicity is a trap. I don't know whether it's a deliberate trap or not. I don't think so, but it's a trap for readers who search for easygoing thinking, which he definitely did not have, right? And but on the other hand, when I read some of some articles about him in the last days, I thought, yeah, there is some over simplicity of his thinking in his early works, which is due to Lou Andreas Salomé, perhaps, because the way he got in contact with Russian culture. I think we need to have a look at this again now, as we know a bit more what Russian culture does, and his way to admire a culture without seeing the poverty and the unfairness that lies within the system, within the political system in itself, but still admiring the Tsar, is something that tells me about his thinking as well as his language, because there is a link, of course, between things, and this is something that comes close to other authors who fell in love with India, or to Nietzsche, who with his Zarathustra, this Orientalism, Orientalistic view of Eastern cultures, like loving a part of the culture but not trying to understand where this part of the culture is actually coming from. And there I feel like this is something that that is being discussed more and more in the last years. Yeah,
that's really interesting. Can I ask you another point about language and density? The other work for which he is celebrated and well known is a prose work, which is sort of translated as Letters to a Young Poet, which incredibly were originally letters to a young poet. The point of that being that they were actually addressed directly to another human being in a way of wanting to make communication as clear as is humanly possible. How does that sit alongside the extraordinary density and complexity of his poetry?
Well, I kind of want to make a plea for the elegies, really, in this regard, because those letters are beautiful, and I think that everyone should read those letters. They're one of the most beautiful instructions to poets that there is, and they are simple and straightforward and heartfelt. The elegies are a different kettle of fish. The elegies are an existential struggle, written in an old form, looking back to Hölderlin, but modernizing it. It's not a true elegy in the classical sense. It's a kind of modern, oblique look at the elegy. It's full of strange punctuation. It's full of strange reversals of verbs. It's a desperate attempt to say something that is unsayable, unsagbar is a word that comes up a lot. And it's difficult poetry because it documents and performs a struggle, really, an existential crisis. Nevertheless, having said that, with moments of beautiful clarity where suddenly there's a rhyme and you think, or a very short line, and a kind of momentary coming to rest and a kind of epiphany of a sort. And it's a kind of ragged thing in a way, with a philosophical argument and a poetic undertow which sweeps in and out a bit like the sea. And I think no wonder it's difficult, because it's trying to say everything about life and death and existence. And, you know, I think one of the ways is to go very simple, but the other way is to really document that struggle.
I think the Duino elegies are difficult. I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, we haven't touched at all on the new poems from earlier, and those poems he wrote in Paris, I mentioned the icon painter earlier on. He's incredibly influenced by visual artists. He spent a time in Worpsteder, where he eventually met his future wife. He also seems to have fallen in love with Paula Becker as well, who married somebody else. And he wrote, and then he'd moved to Paris, and he was working with Rodin, and he was incredibly enthusiastic about Cézanne and so on. So that idea of seeing was very, very important. And Rodin told him to go out and look at things and to sketch, basically in language, to sketch things, which is what many of the new poems are about. I think the Duino elegies is something else altogether. there's something much more organic about the elegies. I mean, it begins with an elegiac kind of feel. And I think the elegy is for the loss of wholeness, for the loss of our place in the world, for the loss of certainty and so on. But eventually, it ceases to be elegiac. It becomes a celebration, and I think you were going to read later on from the ninth. By the time we get to the seventh elegy and the ninth elegy, then we are talking about celebration, and he seems to have found perhaps some sort of solution or an interim solution or something to some of those difficulties that cry, that scream at the beginning seems to raise.
Can I ask you both a question about translation? One of the ironies of this poetry is that most people will come to it not in the original language. His English language readership is huge in America and around the world, and inevitably, just in terms of numbers, is going to be the first port of entry for most people. What challenges does it present in terms of him specifically, and how do you begin to tune into his voice, and what are the linguistic challenges, actually, from the simple linguistic challenges of moving from German into English? You know, 2 minutes, go.
I was going to say, how long have you got? I was interested, Pushkin have recently published, the very first translation of the Duino elegies was published in 1931, Hogarth Press, by Vita and Edward Sackville West. And that's been superseded in most people's minds by the Leishman-Spender version. But the Sackville Wests said in their introduction, with translation, the problem, therefore, was how to render the wide, slow Miltonic progress. I don't think it's always slow, and I don't think it's always Miltonic, but you could take the point of Rilke's line, like an immense road admitting many thoughts and images abreast of one another and seeming to suggest movement in more directions than one. And I think we probably didn't dwell on Holderlin quite enough, but a lot of that comes from his influence, I think. A lot of the difficulty, he is dealing, particularly in the Duino elegies, with philosophical debate, which is difficult to get into poetry at the best of times. He's also very interested, or indeed eager, to sort of trace the ebb and flow of that kind of debate. So he flirts often with contradiction, and that, as a translator, you suddenly think, hang on, what's going on here? Am I getting this wrong, or what is he doing? Also from Holderlin, there's this incredibly complex, extended kind of use of syntax, which goes on crossing line after line after line after line. Very, very difficult to follow, I think. This, for example, we should try and hear a bit more of him. This is from the first elegy, I think. From the ninth, actually. But truly, when he's celebrating our life on earth, our being here, truly, because being here is so much, because everything in this fleeting world seems to need us, calls to us strangely, us, the most fleeting of all, just once for each thing, once and no more, and we too just once and never again, yet to have been this once and so utterly, even only once, our having been on this earth can never be undone. That kind of long, winding sort of sentence there. He pushes language because, as Karen says, he's pushing what is expressible. There's a moment in the eighth elegy. The eighth is one of those ones that between the seventh and ninth, where he seems to maybe take a step back, and there's something slightly more pessimistic about the way we live in comparison to animal life, and the animals, he suggests, perceive the world as a kind of open, whereas we're locked into our kind of subjective, objective categories. A rather wonderful bit here, I think. Even for a single day, he loves his italicization as well, which is, as a translator, you have to decide whether you're going to do that or not. It looks odd in modern verse, but we do not have that pure space before us into which flowers endlessly bloom. We face always, capital, world, and never, capital, nowhere, without the, capital, no. So he's sort of taking this idea that there is a there and a here, and what animals see is a sort of, not disembodied, that would be completely wrong, but what animals see is a where. There is no division between self and other.
I think that this is brilliant.
I could go on.
I want you to go on. But in going on, what I would like... I invited each of our contributors to choose one part of the Duino elegies that they would like to read. And we're going to hear it, each of these parts, from the first, fifth and ninth elegy. First in English, A, because Martin's version is fantastic, and B, so you'll know, if you're not German speakers, exactly what's going on. And then Ulrika is going to read the same piece in German. And I also invite each of them to introduce why they've made this choice and what they want us to listen for.
So I was going to go first. I thought we should hear the opening of the first elegy. We've touched on that first couple of lines. As I say, it is that cry. It's the motivation of the cry, which I think is interesting, and it's motivated by our solitude and alienation and uncertainty. But we are crying probably in the wrong direction. He then goes on. He answers that question quite quickly, as you'll hear. Who hears us? Who could we turn to for help? He wonders if it's better or easier for lovers, they at least have each other as companionship, and he mentions in this section Gaspara Stampa, who was an Italian noblewoman. I forget her dates. She fell in love, she was then rejected, and she then wrote, as you do, 300 sonnets to her lover. But Rilke, very strangely, suggests that unrequited love is somehow better. He also wonders if it's not so good for lovers. Is it better? Is the situation better for heroic figures? I think I think he suggests men of action, men particularly of action, which again I think comes from Hölderlin. So this is the English. Who, if I cried out, would hear me among the ranks of the angels? Even if one of them clasped me suddenly to his heart, I'd wither in the face of his more fierce existence. For their beauty is really nothing but the first stirrings of a terror we are just able to endure and are astonished at the way it elects with such careless disdain to let us go on living. Every angel is terrifying. So I hold back, I swallow back the bird call of black grief that would burst from me. Ah, who is it we can turn to for help? Not angels, not other people. Even the knowing creatures already dumbly see we do not feel at home in our interpretations of the world, though there is perhaps a specific tree on a hillside we settle on over and over, or yesterday's stroll remains through the usual streets, the comforting loyalty of a habit that took a liking to us, that moved in, and now will not leave us alone. Oh, but the night, night with a wind that comes as if filled with infinity and gnaws at our faces, this is what awaits every one of us, the looked for, tender disenchantment of the night, so hard for hearts alone to bear. Though is it any easier for lovers? They make use of each other to hide what they know must otherwise come. Don't you see this yet? Fling this emptiness out of your arms, back into the spaces into which we breathe, and suddenly the birds will feel the more expansive air, will sense it, perhaps with a more fervent flying. Yes, the springtimes needed you. There were stars waiting to be seen by you, a wave rolled to your feet in the past, or as you strode beneath half-shuttered windows, the bowed violin lent itself to you. All this was your mission. But were you up to it? Weren't you more often distracted by anticipation, as if everything about you was there only to herald a beloved? Oh, but where would you keep her? What with strange thoughts looming in and out of your head from dawn to dark, so often staying the night? Rather, if desire tempts you, sing of the lovers, those famous ones, though even their love's not immortal enough, those you almost envy them this, forsaken, abandoned, and unrequited, who have so much more loving in them than those who are satisfied. Like them, begin and begin again the eternal task of praising. Remember this. The hero lives forever. His death is no more than a pretext for being, for his latest birth, whereas lovers are withdrawn, sapped and spent back into nature, as if it had no strength left to create their like again. Have you imagined the love of Gaspara Stampa? Recalled it so intensely that any girl deserted by her lover might emulate her fine example and might say to herself, let me be like her. Because isn't it time this oldest of heartaches finally bore us some fruit? Isn't it time, though still loving, we learned to wrench ourselves free of the beloved? And though trembling, endure, as the arrow endures the tensed bowstring, becomes something more than itself in the leap of release. For our point of rest is nowhere.
Wer, wenn ich schrie, hörte mich denn aus der Engel Ordnungen? Und gesetzt selbst, es nähme einer mich plötzlich ans Herz, ich verginge von seinem stärkeren Dasein. Denn das Schöne ist nichts als des schrecklichen Anfang, den wir noch gerade ertragen, und wir bewundern es so, weil es gelassen verschmäht, uns zu zerstören. Ein jeder Engel ist schrecklich. Und so verhalte ich mich denn und verschlucke den Lockruf dunklen Schluchzens. Ach, wen vermögen wir denn zu brauchen? Engel nicht, Menschen nicht. Und die findigen Tiere merken es schon, dass wir nicht sehr verlässlich zu Haus sind in der gedeuteten Welt. Es bleibt uns vielleicht irgendein Baum an dem Abhang, dass wir ihn täglich wiedersehen. Es bleibt uns die Straße von gestern und das verzogene Treusein einer Gewohnheit, bei der es bei uns gefiel, und so blieb sie und ging nicht. Oh, und die Nacht, wenn der Wind voller Weltraum uns am Angesicht zehrt, wem bliebe sie nicht, die ersehnte, sanft enttäuschende, welche dem einzelnen Herzen mühsam bevorsteht. Ist sie den Liebenden leichter? Ach, sie verdecken sich nur miteinander ihr Los. Weißt du's noch nicht? Wirf aus den Armen die Leere zu den Räumen hinzu, die wir atmen. Vielleicht, dass die Vögel die erweiterte Luft fühlen mit innigerem Flug. Ja, die Frühlinge brauchen dich wohl. Es muteten manche Sterne dir zu, dass du sie spürtest. Es hob sich eine Woge heran im Vergangenen, oder da du vorüberkamst am geöffneten Fenster, gab eine Geige sich hin. Das alles war Auftrag, aber bewältigtest du's? Warst du nicht immer noch von Erwartung zerstreut, als kündigte alles eine Geliebte dir an? Wo willst du sie bergen, da doch die großen fremden Gedanken bei dir aus- und eingehen und öfters bleiben bei Nacht? Sehntest dich aber, so singe die Liebenden. Lange, noch nicht unsterblich genug ist ihr berühmtes Gefühl. Jene, du neidest sie fast, Verlassenen, die du so viel liebender fandst als die Gestillten. Beginn immer von Neuem die nie zu erreichende Preisung. Denk, es erhält sich der Held, selbst der Untergang war ihm nur ein Vorwand zu sein, seine letzte Geburt. Aber die Liebenden nimmt die erschöpfte Natur in sich zurück, als wären nicht zweimal die Kräfte, dieses zu leisten. Hast du der Gaspara Stampa denn genügend gedacht, dass irgendein Mädchen, dem der Geliebte entging, am gesteigerten Beispiel dieser Liebenden fühlt, dass ich würde wie sie? Sollen nicht endlich uns diese ältesten Schmerzen fruchtbarer werden? Ist es nicht Zeit, dass wir liebend uns vom Geliebten befreien und es bebend bestehen? Wie der Pfeil die Sehne besteht, um gesammelt im Absprung mehr zu sein als er selbst. Denn bleiben ist nirgends.
Just fantastic. Wonderful. Thank you both very much. Just wonderful. Let's move on to five. This is your choice,
yes.
Ulrika. Mm-hmm. Would you just tell us why you've chosen it and what we should listen out for?
Karen also asked me why I chose it, meanwhile knowing that I would choose it. And this is interesting because I couldn't tell her why I chose it. I guess it's because I'm also a wandering person, a moving person. I'm, but also so I can kind of relate to that image of a person doing these jumps very up high in the air, in the space, in the Weltall, then going into the deep grounds, but only to get more energy out of the deepness, so I can out of the depths, so I can kind of relate to that. And also, I find this fifth elegy rather joyful. It's playful. It of course it deals with the depths, but only to jump again. And I love the way, and also that, and there he goes back to the Book of Images, because this is inspired actually by a painting. I have tried to find the painting, and so I've asked around some friends who also are Rilke readers whether they would know which painting it is. It's of course, I mean, it's a Picasso painting, that far we know, and Hertha König, who was one of his friends and his host for a couple of time. He got to know her in Munich, and then she invited him to her home at Gut Buckel. So he stayed there for a couple of weeks only, I think, and there he must have seen this painting, and the painting by it, I think Picasso wrote several acrobats painting, and the only one that I could find and that people told me is the one that inspired him to this painting, it doesn't really show what he's telling. There is no carpet, there's only rather tired, exhausting looking acrobats standing somewhere in the vast. And I assume either there is another painting that Hertha König owned, or, which is probably it, the painting, the image was in his head. So he created a whole scene full of joyfulness and ups and down and metaphoric movements of a rather sad painting. And this is what I kind of like about it.
Okay, can we listen to it in English again first?
This is the last, I think, of the elegies that he wrote, and interestingly, he placed it right in the middle. Mm-hmm. I think he's also remembering when he was in Paris, there was a troupe of mm-hmm. acrobats, and he wrote one of the new poems, I think, is about that. I'm really interested, you see this is so joyful.
Yeah, I mean, joy, this is aren't the most joyful things on the same time the saddest things? Isn't this what joy is all about in the end in poetry? That it gives it creates a balance. Mm. Of course, this is desperate, but when it has, we will see it in the rhythm. It has a very joyful melodic rhythm also.
We should also say joyful for Rilke.
Yes.
This is the joke that we... Yeah. Formally, this is also really interesting because it's incredibly free lines. Fifth elegy. But tell me, who are these drifters, even more transient than we are, wrung out from the start by some relentless will, and for whose sake? Still it rings them and bends them, slings and swings them, tosses them up and catches them again, and they tumble as if through oiled and more slippery air to stamp the threadbare carpet worn thin with their feet, their constant leaping up on a carpet cut loose in the universe, laid out here like a plaster, as if the suburban sky had wounded the earth. And barely discernible, yet upstanding and unmistakably on display, the capital D of destiny. The unrelenting grip of it dallies with them, rolls even the toughest, and plays with them the way Augustus the Strong would crush tin plates at his table. Ah, and about the midpoint gathers the rose of those who look on. They bloom and fall away from around this pounding pestle, this pistol fertilized by the kicked-up dust of its own pollen, though it can bear only a joyless, false fruit. The witless, gawping faces, the glazed veneer and vacant smirk of boredom. There, the shriveled up, wrinkled weightlifter, an old man who only beats a drum now, so shrunken in his baggy skin it looks big enough to have once held two of him. The other, already laid in a graveyard, and he, the lone survivor, deaf, and growing at times a little muddled in his widowed skin. But there is the one, the man who might be the offspring of a neck and a nun, bulging and strapping, full of muscles and innocence. Oh, you, all given over to a grief when it was still small, given like a plaything during one of its long convalescences. Then you, who drop down 100 times a day with the kind of bruising only unripened fruit knows out of the tree of your collaborative efforts, which in a few minutes runs through spring, summer, autumn quicker than water. You fall down, thud, on the grave. Sometimes, in a momentary pause, a tender look to your seldom affectionate mother tries to establish itself in your face. But no, your body overpowers it, that shy face you scarcely attempt. And again, the man claps his hands for a leap, and before a pain can grow any sharper or closer to your galloping heart, you feel a stinging in the soles of your feet, running ahead of the real cause of pain, and chasing a pair of smarting, quick tears to your eyes. And yet, blindly, that smile.
Wer aber sind Sie? Sag mir, die Fahrenden, diese ein wenig flüchtiger noch als wir selbst, die dringend von früh an wringt, ein wem zuliebe niemals zufriedener Wille, sondern er wringt sie, biegt sie, schlingt sie und schwingt sie, wirft sie und fängt sie zurück, wie aus geölter, glatterer Luft kommen sie nieder, aus dem verzerrten, von ihrem ewigen Aufsprung dünneren Teppich, diesem verlorenen Teppich im Weltall, aufgelegt wie ein Pflaster, als hätte der Vorstadthimmel der Erde dort wehgetan. Und kaum dort, aufrecht, da und gezeigt, des Dastehens großer Anfangsbuchstab. Schon auch die stärksten Männer rollt sie wieder zum Scherz, der immer kommende Griff wie August der Starke bei Tisch einen zinnenden Teller. Ach, und um diese Mitte, die Rose des Zuschauens, blüht und entblättert. Um diesen Stampfer, den Stempel, den von dem eigenen blühenden Staub getroffenen, zur Scheinfrucht wieder der Unlust befruchteten, ihre niemals bewussten, glänzend mit dünnster Oberfläche leicht scheinlächelnden Unlust. Da, der welke, faltige Stämmer, der Alte, der nur noch trommelt, eingegangen in seiner gewaltigen Haut, als hätte sie früher zwei Männer enthalten und einer läge nun schon auf dem Kirchhof und er überlebte den anderen, taub und manchmal ein wenig wirr in der verwitweten Haut. Aber der Junge, der Mann, als wäre er der Sohn eines Nackens und einer Nonne, prall und strammig erfüllt mit Muskeln und Einfall. Oh, ihr, die ein Leid, das noch klein war, einst als Spielzeug bekam, in einer seiner langen Genesungen. Du, der mit dem Aufschlag, wie nur Früchte ihn kennen, unreif täglich 100-mal abfällt vom Baum der gemeinsam erbauten Bewegung, der rascher als Wascher, rascher als Wasser in wenig Minuten Lenz Sommer und Winter hat, abfällt und anprallt ans Grab. Manchmal in halber Pause will dir ein liebes Antlitz entstehen hinüber zu deiner selten zärtlichen Mutter. Doch an deinen Körper verliert sich, der es flächig verbraucht, das schüchtern kaum versuchte Gesicht. Und wieder klatscht der Mann in die Hand zu dem Ansprung, und ehe dir jemals ein Schmerz deutlicher wird in der Nähe des immer trabenden Herzens, kommt das Brennen der Fußsohlen ihm, seinen Ursprung, zuvor mit ein paar dir rasch in die Augen gejagten leiblichen Tränen. Und dennoch, blindlings, das Lächeln. I think our different take has to do with the question of humor, perhaps, because I feel like in this elegy there is more, there is a certain distance to the pain. So it's like as he can look at the pain and the not answer love with a sort of, yeah, with a tiny distance that allows to love about this, about the saddest things, and that also allows him to almost exaggerating his images, like somebody who is the son of a neck and a nun.
Yes.
Isn't that's of, we all know precisely what this person look like, and I really like the distance that's coming up here, and I miss it in the earlier elegy. So I'm sort of glad or grateful for him to have gone through this crisis. Mm. And coming out of it with a sort of not, when you're not quite through it, but you are starting to be able to look at it from above or something like that. Yeah.
It is interesting. It's the last one he wrote, and I think the last one, the tenth,
it is, yeah,
also is, it has got a very different tone to a lot of it as well.
Also, just say, I have never, having studied German at university, I've never been, ever in my life, been more aware of how staggeringly beautiful the vowel sounds of the German language are than when you read that. Breathtaking. Mm. And we should have a whole long conversation about
yeah,
about the structure of... No, we shouldn't. Not now. but one day. I'm sorry we're running over time, but I don't want to stop, and I don't think you want me to stop either. And I really don't want to stop, Karen, because... You're going to bring us home with the ninth.
Bring us home, yes. That's the thing. So after this long struggle through the nine elegies, when he feels alone and he suggests all these models of being, so the heroes, the men of action, children, lovers, and then the acrobats. In the end, he realizes, of course, the only point of our existence is being human. And the elegies enact that struggle, and we see him full of doubt, and then moments of epiphany, and then doubt again, and crisis, and animals, of course, was one of the other things he suggests. And then just after he's thought about animals, he comes to the ninth elegy. And as Martin has said, the tenth is something different, where he kind of shifts the whole argument into a sort of metaphor or a symbol or a strange other world. But the ninth is the sort of end of the progression. And I like it because it's about the fact that we're alone in the universe, and all we have is ourselves, and all we have is our own creative potential and our own being. And he comes to that through our very fragility and our fleetingness. And that's an extraordinary thing, and that if you can say yay to life on those terms, fleeting and impermanent and and with death, then you truly own existence. And so that's what he sort of ends up. And it starts with a question, just like the first elegy, and you'll hear lots of things that were in the first elegy sort of come back again, part of that ebb and flow I talked about. I'm just going to read a bit of it. I'm not going to read the triumphant conclusion. You can go and find that yourselves. But just one other thing. It's very abstract still. And one of the things I like so much about Martin's translations is that he brings them down to earth as well. They're very earthly translations, which, as you'll see, this is what this one is about. So I'm going to start not quite, very much in a Rilke way, in medias res. I'm not going to read the first bit, which he asks, why would we want to be human, heaven's sake, given everything that we've heard already. But then goes on, and I'll read the English. But truly, because being here is so much, because everything in this fleeting world seems to need us, calls to us strangely, us, the most fleeting of all, just once for each thing, once and no more, and we too, just once and never again. Yet to have been this once, and so utterly, even if only once, our having been on this earth can never be undone. And in the German there, the German is widerrufbar, so it goes back to that ruf, that call right at the beginning. And so we press on and try to achieve it, trying with our simple hands to encompass it, in our over-brimming gaze, in our speechless heart, trying to become it. Who can we give it to? We should hold on to it all forever. Ah, but what can we carry over into the other relationship? Not the way of seeing that has so slowly been learned, and nothing that has happened, nothing. The suffering, then. And above all the heavy weight and the long experience of love, just those things that are inexpressible. But later, standing beneath the stars, what is the use? They are better left unspoken. For when the traveller comes from the mountain to the valley, he brings not a handful of earth, inexpressible to others, but brings rather a word he has won, a pure word, the yellow and blue gentian. Perhaps we are here to say house, bridge, fountain, gate, jug, fruit, tree, window, at most column, tower. But to speak them, you understand, oh, you are to say them with more intensity than the beings, than things themselves ever dreamed they would be. Is this not the sly intent of this secretive world when it urges lovers together that each thing should shudder with joy in their passion? Threshold, what is it for two lovers, little by little, wearing away the ancient threshold of the door, in their turn following others who went before, and still others closing behind, lightly. Here is the time for what can be said. Here, it's home. So speak out and bear witness. More than ever, things that we might experience are falling away, are being elbowed aside and replaced by acts without images, acts beneath incrustations that burst easily the moment the innards seek out new boundaries for themselves. Between the hammers beats our heart, as the tongue is still between our teeth, and still it can give praise. And maybe given the time, I'll just read my favourite one little verse from that in German. We've already heard it, but given that it's about being once, it can never be heard too many times. Aber weil hier sein viel ist und weil uns das scheinbar alles das Hiesige braucht, dieses Schwindende, das seltsam uns angeht, uns die Schwindendsten einmal, jedes nur einmal, einmal und nicht mehr und wir auch einmal, nie wieder. Aber dieses einmal gewesen zu sein, wenn auch nur einmal irdisch gewesen zu sein, scheint nicht widerrufbar.
I am absolutely awestruck by all three of you. Thank you very much indeed. Can I just say how deeply grateful I am to the people in the room I've seen who have been to almost all these sessions. Also to Chloe for letting us do this and put this celebration of dead poets alongside the incredible contemporary programming that Stephanie Sequeira has put together for the rest of this weekend and for the whole festival. I also need to say that throughout all of this, we've been helped by Andy Playford, who runs the technicals here, Rob, who's been managing the internet, the most incredible group of volunteers and staff who have supported us throughout all of this. Thank you to them very much indeed. I also have to say that Nigel and Alison Falls, who sponsored this event, and the Arts Council of England, who sponsor the whole thing, are wonderful patrons to have. If you don't have incredibly posh, you know, aristocrats with palaces, this is the next best thing. Thank you three very much indeed, and most of all to you here and you on Zoom, thank you.
I'll be very brief, ladies and gentlemen, but I just can't, we can't let you go without at least the Poetry Festival and me as Chair of Trustees taking this opportunity to thank our patron, Peter Florence, for the amazing work that he has done in presenting these 12 events in the series of the Dead Poets Society. He's done it so brilliantly throughout the 10 days of the festival, and we are so grateful to him because of the work that's involved, but also because he does it with such grace and, very importantly, with such respect for our poets and for our audiences. So, Peter, a big thank you.